Some Latin hymns, a little Greek, some idiosyncratic natural history, and in Irish, his own perfect poem about his cat, Panga Bawn. Thinking no doubt of his Irish home, the scribe also writes down this sentence from Horace. Caelum non animum mutant qui trans mare current. They change their sky, but not their soul, who cross the ocean. A good maxim for all exiles, and, in this context, a reminder of the constancy of Irish personality. There is much we do not know about these Irish exiles. Their clay and wattle buildings have long since disappeared, and even most of their precious books have perished. But what they knew, the Bible and the literatures of Greece, Rome, and Ireland, we know, because they passed these things on to us. The Hebrew Bible would have been saved without them, transmitted to our time by scattered communities of Jews. The Greek Bible, the Greek commentaries, and much of the literature of ancient Greece were well enough preserved at Byzantium, and might still be available to us somewhere, if we had the interest to seek them out. But Latin literature would almost surely have been lost without the Irish, and illiterate Europe would hardly have developed its great national literatures without the example of Irish, the first vernacular literature to be written down. Beyond that, there would have perished in the West not only literacy, but all the habits of mind that encourage thought. And when Islam began its medieval expansion, it would have encountered scant resistance to its plans, just scattered tribes of animists ready for a new identity. Whether this state of affairs would have been better or worse than what did happen, I leave to the reader to ponder. But what is certain is that the white martyrs, clothed like druids in distinctive white wool robes, fanned out cheerfully across Europe, founding monasteries that would become, in time, the cities of Lumiège, Auxerre, Lyon, Luxeuil, Liège, Trier, Würzburg, Regensburg, Rheinau, Reichenau, Salzburg, Vienna, St. Gall, Bobbio, Fiesole, and Lucca, to name but a few. The weight of the Irish influence on the continent, admits James Westfall Thompson, is incalculable. Saint Fursa, the visionary, went from Ireland to East Anglia, then to Lagny, just east of Paris, then to Perronne, which would be known in time as Perronna Scotorum, Perun of the Irish, and City of Fursey. Caidoc and Fricor advanced on Picardy. Virgil the Geometer, an Irish satirist, became Archbishop of Salzburg. The scholar Donatus, according to his epitaph, Scotorum sanguine creatus, born of Irish blood, was chosen in a popular election to be Bishop of Fiesole, where he ruled for nearly 50 years. St. Cahal, widely venerated to this day in southern Italy as San Cataldo, was surprised on his way back from pilgrimage in the Holy Land to find himself elected Bishop of Taranto, a city on the arch of Italy's boot. Women exiles went forth as well, and though we know even less about them than we know about the men, the continental churches dedicated to Bridget in France, Germany, Austria, and Italy offer some evidence of their presence. At Amay in Belgium, There was even discovered in 1977 a sarcophagus ornamented in the Celtic manner and showing the image of a woman, mysteriously labelled Saint Crodora, who carries a bishop's crozier. More than half of all our biblical commentaries between 650 and 850 were written by Irishmen. Before the end of the 8th century, the exiles had reached Modra in Moravia, where an old church has been dug up that looks just like the little church at Glendalough, and there are traces of the white martyrs as far as Kiev. But an adequate list of missionaries and their foundations would fill another chapter. Suffice it to say that as late as 870, Hierric of Auxerre can still exclaim in his Life of Saint Germanus, "Almost all of Ireland, despising the sea, is migrating to our shores with a herd of philosophers." By this point, the transmission of European civilization was assured. Wherever they went, the Irish brought with them their books, many unseen in Europe for centuries, and tied to their waists as signs of triumph, just as Irish heroes had once tied to their waists their enemies' heads. Wherever they went, they brought their love of learning and their skills in bookmaking. In the bays and valleys of their exile, they re-established literacy and breathed new life into the exhausted literary culture of Europe. And that is how the Irish saved civilization. Chapter 7. The End of the World. Is there any hope? At Pentecost of 597, just days before the mighty Columbkill breathed his last in his island monastery of Iona, an English king was baptized in his capital of Canterbury by a timid Roman librarian whom Gregory the Great had sent to evangelize the English. Though Patrick had brought the gospel to the Irish more than a century and a half earlier, and Columbkill had departed to the Scots 40 years previously, this is the first instance of a papal mission to the pagans. Thus begins a new chapter in the story of Britain, whose first Christian inhabitants, the Celtic Britons of Patrick's day, had been gradually pushed westward by those marauding pagan adventurers, the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, who had, at length, settled down to call East Britain their own. By the time of Columbkill's death, these Germanic settlers were long established in southern Britain, which they now called England, and had given their home territories new names, like Kent, Essex, East Saxony, Wessex, West Saxony, and Sussex, South Saxony. They continued to push the Celtic Britons ever westward, on to the Cornish Peninsula and past the River Severn into Wales. In the far north, they pressed beyond Hadrian's Wall, as far as the River Tweed, the border of present-day Scotland, where they established the kingdom of Northumbria. Their relentless pressure was the central fact of life for their victims, the old Britons, who were both Celtic and Christian, and who despised their pagan foe. The last thing these British Celts would have considered was to bring the gospel to such beasts. The Irish Celts, who had not suffered at Anglo-Saxon hands, had no such inhibitions. Just as the new English invaded the old Celtic territories, the Irish monks launched a spiritual invasion of England from their island monastery of Lindisfarne in the northeast corner of Northumbria, establishing new monasteries in brisk succession. On account of this activity, Aidan, Columbkill's beloved disciple and first abbot of Lindisfarne, has far better claim than Augustine of Canterbury to the title Apostle of England. For, as the Scottish historian James Bullock has remarked, all England north of the Thames was indebted to the Celtic mission for its conversion. Nor was Lindisfarne the only launching pad for the Irish monks. They were on good terms with the British Celts and began to set up bases in the Western territories as well. But the stricter Roman Christianity of Augustine's Canterbury was also slowly spreading north and west through the English territories and was bound eventually to meet Celtic Christianity marching in the opposite direction. A clash of custom and sensibility was as unavoidable as it had been between Columbanus and the Burgundian bishops. It came to a head at a synod held in 664 at the Abbey of Whitby in Northumbria, at which the Northumbrian king ruled in favour of the Roman party, that is, the party who were heirs to Augustine's papal mission. The main issue, as had also, by the way, been the case in the Burgundian synod, was the correct date for celebrating Easter. The Roman party thought the Celtic calculation, which differed from their own by a few days, or in some years, weeks, tantamount to heresy. In the Church's early centuries, dominated by the subtleties of Greek thought, one needed to misunderstand the exact relationship between Christ's divine and human natures, or assert that he had more than one persona, or something equally obscure, in order to qualify as a proper heretic. The early Christian fathers could not have been bothered with anything as mundane as calendrical calculations. It is a mark of how simple-minded and inflexible the thought of the age had become, that the issue of a calendar could have come so close to precipitating schism. As it happened, the Irish party gave in, with a few holdouts who came over in time. They agreed, however reluctantly, that their father in God, Columbkill, whose name was invoked in all their customs, took second place to Peter, the Prince of the Lord's Apostles, in whose name the Roman party made its argument. The solution, like the problem, was a simple-minded one. Our relics, the bones of our founder, are holier than yours. So Rome is greater than Iona, and thus we've got right on our side. The scene at Whitby has been used repeatedly by both Anglicans and Roman Catholics to defend their positions against each other. And it is almost impossible to read any historian of this period without getting a whiff of partisanship. For Anglicans, the clash proves that there was an indigenous British church that preceded Roman interference. For Catholics, the Celtic acquiescence is proof that once the Celtic Christians thought things through, they saw that Rome was the necessary norm of orthodoxy. Far too much, I suspect, has been made of this clash. As much as anything, because our source, Bede, a monk historian in the early 8th century at the Northumbrian Abbey of Jarrow, a satellite of Lindisfarne, makes so much of it. A man of his time, and a most seductive storyteller, Bede was, though a great admirer of Irish spirituality and learning, painfully impressed by the importance of uniformity. A more balanced perspective is suggested by Comyn, an Irish abbot who helped bring the Celtic party over to the Roman observance by humorously deprecating the Celtic argument. What thing more perverse can be felt of our church than if we say Rome is wrong, Jerusalem is wrong, Antioch is wrong, the whole world is wrong. Only the Irish and the Britons know what is right. These people who are almost at the ends of the earth, and, you might say, a pimple on the chin of the world. In other words, universal opinion, not some arbitrary Roman rule, should induce the Celts to change their mind. The trivial nature of the clash may be seen especially in the other item on Whitby's agenda, the Irish tonsure, which, unlike the Roman shaved circlet at the crown of the head, was achieved by shaving the front of the head from ear to ear and letting the hair in the back grow long. Even to our eyes, the Irish tonsure would have a ludicrous appearance, but to the Romans it was proof of barbarian status. How could people who look so ridiculous mean to suggest that this absurd tonsure was a sign of consecration? What is far more impressive about the period as a whole, and perhaps even about what actually happened at Whitby, is the close fraternal cooperation between the Irish and the English. The Christian Saxons at all times received the Irish warmly as elder brothers and sisters in Christ, and borrowed generously from these generous elders. If Christians of different tribes had in all ages cooperated with one another as did these men and women, the world would be a very different place. The Saxon monasteries, often founded by Irish monks, learned from them the scribal arts and reverence for the written word. The Lindisfarne Gospels, as consummate an example of Irish scribal art as the Book of Kells, is the work of Edfrith, successor to Aidan, as abbot of Lindisfarne. The same Edfrith, to whom Aldhelm of Malmesbury had written when he was an English student in Ireland, warning him about Irish laxity in regard to pagan literature. Though the Lindisfarne Gospels, almost the only codex for which we have a scribe's name, is the work of an Englishman, it is utterly Irish in spirit. The Saxons also absorbed the Celtic piety toward their ancestral past, and continue to tell stories of their ancient heroes. Just as the Irish did, they often reimagined these tales and gave them a Christian spin. Beowulf, the great Germano-English hero, is a pagan warrior, sure enough, but he is presented as a model of Saxon manhood, loyal, courageous, generous. And, as the poet told the tale, the English Christian audience would have picked up the hints concealed within the poet's text, that Beowulf grappling with the monsters was a type of Christ grappling with Satan. Both the Celtic and the Saxon myths and legends were becoming, in fact, secular Old Testaments, histories that lacked the direct revelations of Abraham and Moses, but symbolic salvation histories nonetheless, where one could read of a people journeying by trial and error, prophecy and instinct, toward the truth, propelled forward through darkness and death by their own innate goodness. The Greek approach to thought was now almost completely lost. Baptism, though it had connected the Irish to a larger world, had hardly made them Athenians, and though the Irish and now the Saxons succeeded in transcribing the works of ancient philosophers, they could not really understand them. Nor, for that matter, could the few remaining Romans of the West, like Gregory the Great. The intellectual disciplines of distinction, definition, and dialectic that had once been the glory of men like Augustine were unobtainable by readers of the Dark Ages, whose apprehension of the world was simple and immediate, framed by myth and magic. A man no longer subordinated one thought to another with mathematical precision. Instead, he apprehended similarities and balances, types and paradigms, parallels and symbols. It was a world, not of thoughts, but of images. Even the Romans at Whitby presented their point of view in the new way. They did not argue, for genuine intellectual disputation was beyond them. They held up pictures for the mind, one set of bones versus another. Indeed, the Northumbrian king, who ruled in favour of the Roman party, did so because he imagined that Peter, Rome's supposed first bishop, to whom Jesus had, in a metaphorical phrase, given the keys of the kingdom of heaven, would use those keys to lock the king out of heaven if he ruled against Rome. Nor did the Romans even trouble to draw up an extended list of charges, as would once have been the case in the church's great councils. After all, the Irish had many peculiar customs, encouraged diversity, enjoyed pagan literature, far more than was good for them, were unconcerned about uniformity of monastic rule, and, perhaps worst of all, sometimes allowed a woman to rule over them. But the synod was held at Whitby, a double monastery of the Celtic style, dependent on Lindus Farm and ruled by the great abbess Hilda. The Roman party wisely confined its objections to the two matters it found most irksome, because they were most visible. By the mid-7th century, the visible image has assumed far greater reality than the invisible thought. Another reason that these provincial practitioners of Romanità were far more circumspect than they might once have been was that the collapse of the empire and the rise of the barbarian fiefdoms had slowed communication considerably. Without the efficient communication system of the Roman Imperium, uniformity was necessarily in peril. For a century and a half, from the middle of the 5th century to the end of the 6th, there had been, so far as we can tell, no formal communication between Rome and the Christians of Britain, nor had there ever been any between Rome and Ireland, which is why the Celts were still keeping Easter according to calculations that had been twice superseded at Rome. On these marginal islands, who could know for sure what was in, what was out in Rome, let alone in the other ancient centres of Christianity? It was a great moment for diversity, and the Irish continued to thrive. By the second half of the 7th century, the Irish missionary impulse was at high tide, supplemented in its force by fresh waves of English missionaries, who, in imitation of their elder brothers, burst upon the Germanic lands whence their ancestors had once come. Wilfred, the leader of the winning party at Whitby, turned his zeal on Frisia. Willibrord found the monastery of Echternach in Luxembourg, whence the Echternach Gospels, spectacular companion to the Lindisfarne Gospels, would spring. And he and Boniface established sees at Utrecht, Würzburg, Erfurt, Eichstätt, and Passau. Boniface founded the great abbey at Fulda, established other monasteries at Diesbodenburg, Amunaburg, Fritzlar, Boreburg, and Heidenheim, and restored the See of Mainz, of which Boniface became archbishop. By the middle of the 8th century, most of Frisia, Saxony, Thuringia, Bavaria, and part of Denmark had received the gospel. To many of these new foundations came the books of the insular scribes. Boniface and Alcuin, the Northumbrian monk at Charlemagne's court, who in 782 took over direction of the Palatine school, which would one day turn into the University of Paris, could never find the books they needed on the continent, and were always sending urgent requests to British foundations for basic works. In truth, the art of the scriptorium was virtually unknown in the indigenous monasteries of Italy and Gaul. Monastic manuscript art had travelled from the workshops of Syria and Egypt by way of Ireland and Britain, and, at last, to the continent of Europe. But now, the depleted store of continental codices rose steadily. By the middle of the 8th century, Fulda, for instance, was employing 40 full-time scribes. The Irish connections of these English monks were not incidental. Besides having profited substantially from the intellectual atmosphere that the Irish foundations had established in Britain, many had studied in Ireland. Willibrord had spent 12 years there, or were assisted in their labours by Irish monks, such as Killian and his 11 companions, who evangelised Franconia and Thuringia. Alcuin's first master, Colgu, had been Irish, as was his best friend Joseph, who accompanied him to France and died beside him. And he was succeeded at the court school by the Irish scholar Clement Scotus. With the advent of Charlemagne as King of the Franks, and after his surprise coronation by the Pope on Christmas Day 800, Holy Roman Emperor, we can begin to speak of France in preference to Gaul. Charlemagne presided over medieval Europe's first Renaissance, a short-lived cultural flowering that barely outlasted his reign. His enduring influence lay in the gradual revival of literacy, for he repeatedly urged and supported the raising of standards in the few poor continental schools that remained. That he himself was an illiterate, who late in life laboriously learned to decipher some simple texts, but could never get the hang of writing, is proof enough of the standards of the age. Without the previous and continuing influx of Irish codices, the Carolingian Renaissance would have been impossible. For this reason, as Charlemagne's biographer Einhard tells us, Charlemagne amabat peregrinos, loved the wandering monks. They seemed indeed to be everywhere. When Charlemagne found himself puzzling over what a solar eclipse might be, Dungal, an Irish recluse at Saint-Denis, was invited to instruct the king in these abstruse matters, which he did in a letter we still possess. Another resident at the Frankish court was the Irishman Dicuil, the first medieval geographer, whose cold-eyed scepticism and wry asides in his Measurement of the Globe still make entertaining reading. Yet another Irish courtier was Sidulius Scotus, a diverting Ciceronian who advised the emperor on statecraft, and whose verses the Empress Ermengarde worked as samplers. Sidulius copied out 3 manuscripts that we still possess. A Greek Psalter in the Arsenal Library at Paris, an interlinear Greek-Latin version of the Gospels at St. Gall, and the Codex Bournerianus at Dresden, which is an interlinear version of Paul's epistles, and which contains the little Irish poem about the unprofitability of pilgrimage to Rome, written, obviously, by Sidulius himself. In addition to these, either Sidulius or someone of his circle is responsible for the St. Gall Priscian, authored by the Latin grammarian and full of juicy Irish glosses, and the Codex Bernensis, containing Horace's odes, Servius's commentary on Virgil, and some of Augustine's early how-to books, written for his rhetoric students. The most splendid blossom of this continental spring was an Irish man, John Scotus Eugener, born about 810, who crossed to France in his early 30s and took a position at the Palatine School, then under the patronage of Charlemagne's successor, Charles the Bald. John Scotus, who was probably a layman, is the first philosopher of the Middle Ages, the first truly Christian philosopher since the death of Augustine in 430, the first European philosopher since the execution of Boethius in 524, the first man in 300 years who was able to think. He also had a vicious sense of humour, penning this two-liner on the death of the anti-Irish Hincmar, Archbishop of Reims. Hic jocet Hincmarus, kleptes vehementer avarus, hoc solum gesit nobile, quod periit. Here lies Hincmar, crook, but savage greed aside, he did one truly noble thing, he died. His wine-soaked dinners with the emperor were full of parrying wit. Quid distat inter sutum et scutum? What separates a fool from an Irishman? Asked the emperor playfully. Tabula tantum. Only the table, came Eugener's reply. No wonder there is a legend that his students finally stabbed him to death with their pens. In his day, he was one of only two residents of Western Europe known to be fluent in Greek. The other, the papal librarian Anastasius, was incredulous that a barbarian like Scotus Eugener should know so much Greek. But know it he did. To read his De Divisione Naturi, The Division of Nature, after immersion in the folk literature we have been reading, is a shocking experience. One is back in the world of Plato. Here is a mind that could grasp the most rarefied distinctions of the Greek philosophical tradition and, far more important, could elaborate a new system of thought, one that is balanced and internally consistent. It has more than a soupçon of Celticity in it, however, for John Scotus's favourite word is nature. A word beloved of the Irish, but one that never failed to raise the hackles of both Platonists and Roman Christians. In John Scotus's system, nature is a virtual synonym for reality. All of reality, our natural world, as well as the reality of God. In Scotus, there is no useful distinction between natural and supernatural. Though the system is both subtle and elaborate, one sees immediately his debt to Patrick's simple worldview. Reality is a continuum, and all God's creatures are theophanies of God himself, for God speaks in them and through them. To readers of a later, more punitive age, this would sound suspiciously like pantheism, the heresy that God is not just in all things, but is all things. That is, that there is no distinction between God and creation. The further they read, the more unorthodox this Irishman's philosophy would appear. He boldly opposed reason to authority. Every authority that is not confirmed by true reason seems to be weak, whereas true reason does not need to be supported by any authority. And this bit of sententiousness he dared apply to the fathers of the church. More than this, he took a perfectly orthodox statement of Paul, that in the end God will be all in all, and used it not only to prop up his pantheism, but to suggest that at the end of time, everyone, even the devils, will be saved. In 1225, almost four centuries after it was written, Pope Honorius III ordered all copies of De Divisione Naturae to be burned. Some obviously escaped the bonfire. But in the age of John Scotus Erugena, Christian churchmen did not burn books. Only barbarians did that. Even as John Scotus was crossing to the continent from Ireland, Ireland was under siege. The Viking terrorists had discovered its peaceful monasteries, now rich in precious objects. The monks built round towers without ground floor entrances and hauled their plate up rope ladders, which they then pulled up after themselves. But such towers were no match for Vikings, nor were the monks, by this time growing sleek and tame. Nor apparently were the warriors, many of whom had turned into relatively peaceful, even erudite, laymen. The illiterate Vikings often destroyed books by ripping off bejeweled covers for booty. The constant fear of the monks is well illustrated in this four-line gloss. Bitter is the wind this night, which tosses up the ocean's hair so white. Merciless men, I need not fear, who cross from Lothland on an ocean clear. The merciless men from Lothland, Norway, could not land in a storm, which soon became the only protection left to the coastal monks of Ireland and Britain. Attacks on magical Lindisfarne, which had become the constant source of the most exquisite of the insular codices, began in the last decade of the 8th century, as we read in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle for 793. On the 6th of the Ides of June, the ravaging of the heathen men lamentably destroyed God's church at Lindisfarne. Monks were stripped and tortured, and the raiders came again in 801 to set the buildings afire, in 806 to kill scores of monks, in 867 to burn the rebuilt abbey. In 875, the harried survivors left Lindisfarne for good. In the first decade of the 9th century came the turn of Columbkill's Iona, where a great number of layfolks and clerics were massacred in repeated raids. The great foundation had at last to be abandoned. Inishmurray was destroyed in 802, never to rise again. Even remote Skellig Michael was raided repeatedly. Its harmless abbot, Etgal, carried off for ransom, but dying of hunger on their hands, as we read in the annals of Inishfallen. Glendalough was pillaged on countless occasions, and between 775 and 1071, destroyed by fire at least 9 times. Bangor, Moville, Clonfert, Clonmacnoise, Bridget's, Kildare, each was laid waste in turn. In 840, even the extensive buildings of Patrick's Armagh were burned to their foundations. as one by one the great monastic civitates fell before the implacable Vikings, precious books and metalware were buried in haste or sent inland to some place thought to be temporarily, at least, more secure. In this way, the greatest of all surviving gospel codices, the Book of Kells, is thought to have been brought from imperiled Lindisfarne to the inland foundation of Kells. In modern times, and still today, a farmer's spade will occasionally uncover some lost treasure, like the Ardagh chalice. Or some noble family, reduced even to peasant status by Ireland's subsequent woeful history, will be found to have preserved through all the centuries a weathered codex as fantastic as the Cathach of Columbkill. To Irish eyes, the Vikings had little to recommend them. They did establish Ireland's first genuine cities, places like Limerick, Cork, Wexford, Waterford, and Dublin. But they interrupted something that could never be resumed. When the Vikings were vanquished in the early 11th century, Irish society recovered, in the sense that the normal business of life sprang back in expectable patterns. But Ireland would never recover its cultural leadership of European civilization. It had been marginalized once more. Nevertheless, the Irish way had already become the leaven of medieval civilization, the unidentified ingredient that suffused the bread of Europe, enabling it to breathe and grow, and escape the humorless confines of Roman uniformity and classical pessimism. Ireland's next invasion, by Normans in the 12th century, changed little. For the Irish Normans adopted Irish customs far more eagerly than the English Normans married with indigenous Saxon culture. The Normans became, in the famous phrase, Hibernis Hiberniores, more Irish than the Irish themselves. Subsequent invaders were not so appreciative. In the 16th century, the colonizing Elizabethans cut down the Irish forests to get at the impenitent dispossessed who harried them, guerrilla style, and contemplated genocide, after the gentle recommendation of the poet Spenser. In the 17th century, the Calvinist Cromwellians came close to implementing this poetic recommendation. In the 18th century, the spirit-crushing penal laws denied Catholics the rights of citizens. But it took the famines of the 19th century, the Great Hunger, to finish the Irish off. Nearly 1 million Irish people died of hunger and its consequences between 1845 and 1851, while Her Majesty's government sat on its hands. And another 1.5 million emigrated during the same period, many of these dying during the difficult passage to North America or Australia. By 1914, an additional 4 million had emigrated, reducing Ireland's population of 1845 by a third, to less than 4.5 million. That such a fertile land should have become incapable of nourishing its beloved children is indication of the economic rape it had suffered for so many centuries. For by this time, Ireland had long been England's first colony, a third world country at the edge of Europe. It would take the Irish cultural and political movements of the 20th century to give back to this devastated population a semblance of its self-respect. If the Vikings lost Ireland its leadership role, the penal laws very nearly destroyed its identity. these crushing anti-Catholic statutes ensured that virtually all the remaining native nobility would flee their ancestral land. By the end of the 18th century, the flight was complete. Art O'Leary was one of the last noblemen to continue to maintain a home in Ireland, and we saw in Chapter 3 what happened to him. Ireland's loss was other nations' gain. Names like Hennessy, the Cognac people, Lally, MacMahon and Walsh in France, Murphy, Kindellan, Mahony and O'Brien in Spain, Taff and Hegarty in Austria, O'Neill in Portugal, O'Rourke in Russia, O'Higgins in Chile, and O'Farrell and Quinn in Mexico, give some indication of where these wild geese, as they were called, fled. For the impoverished peasants who remain behind, the ruined woods and despoiled castles of Ireland were elegiac reminders of a glorious past, now peopled by aristocratic ghosts, as in the anonymous Kilcash. What shall we do for timber? The last of the woods is down. Kilcash and the house of its glory and the bell of the house are gone. The spot where the lady waited, who shamed all women for grace, when earls came sailing to greet her, and mass was said in the place. My grief and my affliction, your gates are taken away. Your avenue needs attention. Goats in the garden stray. The courtyard's filled with water, and the great earls, where are they? The earls, the lady, the people, beaten into the clay. But we cannot leave the Irish beaten into the clay. In all disasters, Patrick would insist, there is ground for hope. Kilcash, whose ruined tower still stands against the Tipperary sky, was the castle of the Anglo-Norman Butler family, whose descendant, William Butler Yeats, would one day bring such honour to Ireland as the greatest poet of the 20th century. Our greatest novelist, James Joyce, was reared in Dublin, Viking stronghold and provincial British capital. Even at their lowest point, the Irish kept the candle of hope burning. In 1843, just before the famines began, a smug German traveller was startled to find evidence of learning in peasant Ireland. I have already mentioned the somewhat antiquated learning, even of the lower classes of the people of Kerry, and now I met with a remarkable instance of it. In the bow of the boat sat a Kerry man, reading an old manuscript, which was written in the Irish language and in the Celtic character. Some, the man told me, he had added himself. Some he had inherited from his father and grandfather. And some had, in all probability, been in his family long before then. I asked him what were its contents. They are, he answered, the most beautiful old Irish poems, histories of wonderful events, and treatises of antiquity. For instance, the translation of a treatise by Aristotle on some subject of natural history. I don't know what it does to you, dear reader, but the unlikely survival of an Irish codex in the gnarled hands of a Kerry farmer sends shivers up my spine. As we, the people of the First World, the Romans of the 20th century, look out across our earth, we see some signs for hope. many more for despair. Technology proceeds apace, delivering the marvels that knit our world together, the conquering of diseases that plagued every age but ours, and the consequent lowering of mortality rates, revolutions in crop yields that continue to feed expanding populations, the contemplated information highway that will soon enable all of us to retrieve information and communicate with one another in ways so instant and complete that they would dazzle those who built the Roman roads, the first great information system. But that road system became impassable rubble as the empire was overwhelmed by population explosions beyond its borders. So will ours. Rome's demise instructs us in what inevitably happens when impoverished and rapidly expanding populations, whose ways and values are only dimly understood, press up against a rich and ordered society. More than 1 billion people in our world today survive on less than $370 a year, while Americans, who constitute 5% of the world's population, purchase 50% of its cocaine. If the world's population, which has doubled in our lifetime, doubles again by the middle of the next century, how could anyone hope to escape the catastrophic consequences? The wrath to come. But we turn our backs on such unpleasantness and contemplate the happier prospects of our technological dreams. What will be lost and what saved of our civilization probably lies beyond our powers to decide. No human group has ever figured out how to design its future. That future may be germinating today, not in a boardroom in London, or an office in Washington, or a bank in Tokyo, but in some antic outpost or other, a kindly British orphanage in the grim foothills of Peru, a house for the dying in a back street of Calcutta run by a fiercely single-minded Albanian nun, an easygoing French medical team at the starving edge of the Sahel, a mission to Somalia by Irish social workers who remember their own great hunger, a nursery program to assist convict mothers at a New York prison. In some unheralded corner, where a great-hearted human being is committed to loving outcasts in an extraordinary way. Perhaps history is always divided into Romans and Catholics, or better, Catholics with a small c. The Romans are the rich and powerful who run things their way and must always accrue more because they instinctively believe that there will never be enough to go around. The Catholics, with a small c, as their name implies, are universalists who instinctively believe that all humanity makes one family, that every human being is an equal child of God, and that God will provide. The 21st century, prophesied Malraux, will be spiritual or it will not be. If our civilization is to be saved, forget about our civilization, which, as Patrick would say, may pass in a moment like a cloud or smoke that is scattered by the wind. If we are to be saved, it will not be by Romans, but by saints.
The End. You've been listening to How the Irish Saved Civilization by Thomas Cahill, narrated by Donal Donnelly. This work, copyrighted 1995 by Thomas Cahill, is recorded by arrangement with the Random House Audio Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. This recording is copyrighted 1995 by Recorded Books Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.